I can say to my new Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra, hey, find a keto-friendly restaurant nearby and text it to Beth and Steve. And it does, without me lifting a finger, so I can get in more squats anywhere I can. One, two, three.
Will that be cash or credit?
Credit. Four.
Galaxy S25 Ultra, the AI companion that does the heavy lifting so you can do you. Get yours at Samsung.com. Compatible with select apps. Requires Google Gemini account. Results may vary based on input. Check responses for accuracy.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with John Norton, distinguished professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. His new book, The Large-Scale Structure of Inductive Inference, is available open access from BSPS Open, University of Calgary Press. Science depends essentially on inductive inferences, inferences that go beyond the evidence on which they are based. But inductive inferences have historically been modeled on deductive inferences, which are valid if and only if they satisfy a valid argument form. In his new book, Norton expands his defense of what he calls the material theory of induction. What makes an induction good is not its conforming to a universal rule, like deduction, but instead by its being warranted by true background facts in a particular domain. Norton argues that while these facts are themselves, in turn, supported by inductive inferences, the resulting network of inductive support does not suffer from vicious circularity, is not a form of coherentist epistemology, and dissolves the infamous problem of induction articulated clearly by Hume. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, John Norton. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. Happy to be here.
I'm really looking forward to talking about your new book, The Large-Scale Structure of Inductive Inference. So before we get to the actual content of the book, maybe you can say a bit about yourself as a philosopher and how this book came about.
Sure, I'd be happy to. My main interest in philosophy of science has been in science itself. I'm very much a science lover. My early work was in the history and philosophy of relativity, especially Einstein's discovery of the general theory of relativity. But the deeper concern has always been a fascination with science itself and a sense that science has managed to do something that other human endeavors have not. And then the question becomes, what is it that makes science special? What makes it special is the strong relationship with evidence. We have good reason to believe the content of our best scientific theories, and those good reasons are coming from accounts of inductive inference. So that's the framing of the work that I'm doing that leads up to the book that you've introduced. Now, the concern was that when I looked at the literature on inductive inference and confirmation theory in philosophy of science, I thought it was scattered and imperfect. There was no single theory. There were many different competing theories. We never seemed to be able to figure out what was the right way to understand relations of inductive support. That was a big problem for me doing history of science, because I wanted to say things like Einstein had good reason and good evidence for this claim, but rather poor reasons or rather poor evidence for that claim. How could I sustain claims like that if I had to shop between different accounts of inductive inference? Sometimes I felt like I was a hypochondriac who was doctor shopping, waiting for the right diagnosis. So I got to thinking very serious about the nature of inductive inference itself, and I decided that the mainstream of work on inductive inference was just flawed in its foundations. It had tried to understand the nature of inductive inference on the model of deductive inference, that is, by looking for universal rules that look like the sorts of universal rules that worked very well in in theories of deductive inference. And I realized that that was actually wrong, that what is justifying an inductive inference? If there's an inductive inference that we know is appropriate, it's good, and it's working the way it should, it's not that it conforms to a particular rule. It's actually being authorized by background facts. Right? There are facts in a domain of application that are saying this is the right inductive inference to apply here. And so that's the basic idea behind the material theory of induction. Inductive inferences are warranted by material facts in the background. And the first book that I wrote, The Material Theory of Induction, just makes that one point at great length with many examples over and over and over again. So shall I continue? How does that connect?
Yeah, well, I mean, you sort of went into the book rather than into yourself, but that's okay. No, that's fine. So I was going to ask, you know, tell us a bit about the material theory itself. So maybe, you know, maybe you can say, well, then let's just jump right into how this book builds on that prior book, right? Where you first put forward the material theory of induction, where, as you just put it, the inductive inferences, the good ones, right, are those that are authorized by background facts in a particular domain. Okay, so this book is called, you know, The Large-Scale Structure of Inductive Inference. So how does the large-scale structure come in?
Well, you've seen the basic setup for any particular inductive inference. If I want to know if this is a good inference, I need to know that that there's a background fact that's doing the warranting. Maybe an example might help, just so it isn't too abstract. Yeah. The example that I like a lot is in chapter one of the first book, and this is Marie Curie's inductive inference over the crystallographic form of radium chloride. I think you know the setup. In 1903, she reports her lengthy investigations on radium after years of fractional crystallization of pitch blend ore. She ends up with a tenth of a gram of an extremely radioactive substance, radium chloride. And she goes on to describe its properties, and she says radium chloride has such and such a crystallographic property, right? It forms crystals of the following type. Now, what she declares there is a generalization, right? And the generalization is over all samples of radium chloride, but it is based on a single sample of radium chloride. There's only one existing in laboratories, in the scientific world, and it's the tenth of a gram in front of Marie Curie. How does that possibly work? Right? How can you do an inductive inference from a single sample to all? Well, the default way that a philosopher of the old school would think about this is to say, well, it's an enumerative induction. Some samples of radium chloride have this property, therefore all do. And I think you can see immediately that just isn't going to work. Long been recognized that that sort of inference just doesn't work because there are too many properties that this one sample of radium chloride has. All right, you have to know which are the properties over which you can carry out that inductive inference. So if you were to confront Curie in her laboratory and demand to know, what are you doing? This is philosophically crazy. She would no doubt be puzzled by what you're saying. She would say, no, I'm not doing that. I can make this particular inference on crystallographic forms specifically because of the way that the crystals are. One of the things we've learned over the past century is that all crystalline substances come in a small set of crystallographic families. And once you've identified a sample as belonging to one of them, then you have a strong basis for arguing that all the other samples will live in that same family. Okay, so that's the way the example works. Mm-hmm. You can see that the key thing is you have to have a background fact that is true. A fact is a truth. And that tells you precisely which properties can be generalized. Right? And Marie Curie knows that the crystallographic forms can be generalized. But now we then face the second problem. Mm-hmm. How do we know that these background facts are indeed facts, that they are indeed true? For Marie Curie to be secure in her inductive inference. She has to know that these facts are indeed correct. And sometimes we might try and make inductive inferences using warranting facts that turn out not to be facts after all. They turn out to be falsehoods, and then we make mistakes. So that's where the large-scale inductive inference comes in. How do we know these other facts? Well, the answer is further inductive inferences. And how do we secure the inductive inferences to these further facts? Well, still further warranting facts. So almost automatically, we're thrown from a small investigation into a single particular inductive inference into a large network of further inductive inferences. And that was certainly the case for Marie Curie working with the crystallographic properties of radium chloride. The facts that were justifying her inductive inference spread out all the way through science. There was a need to identify which are the chemical elements. Until you know which are the chemical elements, it's difficult to get a clear sense over the crystallographic forms. You need to know a lot about the atomic constitution of matter, because crystals are formed from atomic lattices. How do those atomic lattices go together? Then there's a tremendous amount of geometry that's involved in figuring out exactly how you can put the different lattices together. And then finally, there's a lot of mathematics. It turns out that the mathematical theory of finite groups is the mathematics that you need that will identify the ways that you can pack these spheres of atoms as they were modeled in the 19th century into lattices. So there's suddenly an enormous amount of further science is all feeding into this one inductive inference. And the character of that large scale structure, all these different differences, how they fit together, that's the topic of the book.
Okay, good, good. So let me just start with a kind of a, before we get into, you know, the characteristics, right? You know, so you go through a number of those, and you defend them, and, you know, one of the things that you do specify is that this is, that the theory is mainly for what you call mature sciences. And so, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking, well, you know, how do you get started with this, you know, large, I mean, it's very nice when, you know, Marie Curie and her radium chloride are embedded in a scientific structure, like physics and, you know, chemistry. But that wasn't always the case, right? So how do you get started? What about the immature sciences? Or what about physics before it was mature?
That's an interesting question of the dynamics of science, and it's something I've addressed at very great length in the book. The short answer is you get started with hypotheses, right? If you don't have access to a warranting fact that will do the work for you, you conjecture something, you hypothesize it, and then you proceed to make your inductive inferences. And then you have to go back and demonstrate that that hypothesis indeed does have inductive support elsewhere. I have very many examples in the book of how this works, how these hypotheses get us started. Here's one very simple example. When chemistry was starting out at the beginning of the 19th century, Dalton had a really serious problem. He needed to figure out what the molecular composition of things like water were. And he conjectured it was just HO, right? One hydrogen atom and one oxygen atom go together to make water. We, of course, now know that it's H2O, right? Mm-hmm. It's not HO or HO2 or HO3 or H7O5 or something like that. So how could you figure that out? Well, Dalton was essentially trapped. He knew that 8 grams of oxygen would combine with 1 gram of hydrogen. So if you knew that that the atoms of each of hydrogen and oxygen weighed the same, then you would know the formula for water is H8O1, right? But if as you discovered that the atomic weights of hydrogen and oxygen were different, then you could figure out that it had to be H2O. Now, of course, the difficulty there is that you don't know the molecular formula until you know the atomic weights, but you don't know the atomic weights until you know the molecular formula. And this was a problem that just stymied Dalton. And it took 50 years of work in chemistry to resolve the difficulty. This is elaborated at great length in one of the chapters. So how did they do it? Well, they did it with hypotheses. And one of the hypotheses is one that everyone learns in high school chemistry. This is Avogadro's hypothesis, that equal volumes of gases under the same conditions of temperature and pressure contain the same number of molecules. So Avogadro hypothesizes this in the early part of the 19th century, and the later chemists realize that that's the key. If that hypothesis is correct, then you can break the circularity and proceed to make the inductive inferences needed to determine that water is indeed H2O. This, as I said, took about 50 years. It was not until Cannizzaro had completed a very lengthy analysis by the end of the 1850s. He circulated a pamphlet at the Karlsruhe Conference of 1860 in which he laid out all of these results. And included in that is, of course, independent evidence for Avogadro's hypothesis. You can hypothesize it, but you can make a mistake. I mean, there are notorious examples of people doing inductive inference with a hypothesis that's false, that doesn't work out. One of my favorite examples is steady-state cosmology from the mid-20th century. Bondi, Gold, and Hoyle hypothesized that the universe on the larger scale is homogeneous, not just in space, but also in time as well. This was the basis of steady-state cosmology. Once you had that hypothesis of the perfect cosmological principle of the sameness on the large scale of the universe over time, you could make all sorts of inferences. One of them would be this. We observe that the universe is expanding, but the matter density of the universe has to stay constant, right? Because it's got to stay roughly the same over time. Therefore, you conclude that matter is being constantly created in the gaps that are being opened up. Right? Now, it's a wonderful piece of science. It all depends on the cogency of the perfect cosmological principle. Is it factual or not? And in the long run, over the course of the decades following, they were unable to sustain the perfect cosmological principle, and so the theory collapsed.
Work management platforms. Ugh, endless onboarding, IT bottlenecks, admin requests. But what if things were different?
We found love in an open space.
Monday.com is different. No lengthy onboarding. Beautiful reports in minutes. Custom workflows you can build on your own. Easy to use prompt-free AI. Huh, turns out you can love a work management platform. Monday.com, the first work platform you'll love to use.
Oh, it's such a clutch off-season pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some from my mom. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
Shop Blinds.com right now and get up to 45% off select styles. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So, I mean, there's a number. Okay. So, I mean, you mentioned circularity, and you did. There's a whole chapter on this issue, and I do want to get to that.
Right.
Yeah, but one of the interesting things that you say about mature sciences, and this also was hinted at by your answer just now. Is this idea that there's just going to be one structure in a, you know, in a mature science. That goes against, you know, certain tendencies, you know, nowadays to be pluralist or even just more generally, the idea that you can have empirically equivalent theories that are inconsistent in certain ways and all possible evidence. I mean, people, you know, obviously voice the concern in a number of different ways, but the core idea being that you can have all the facts, all the evidence, and yet have two mutually inconsistent theories that take care of all the facts and even all possible facts. I mean, it depends on how expansive you want to be. And you like basically deny that.
Yeah, because it's wrong.
So how do you get to the idea that no, there's just going to be one? We're never in a, at least in a mature science. I mean, maybe you're building a lot into the idea of maturity, but the idea that nope, we're just going to end up with one large scale inductive, you know, network per mature domain.
Well, a lot to say. First, there's no inevitability that we'll get that sort of structure. I characterize mature science as one in which every essential claim of the science is well supported by the evidence. If you look at a well-supported science, you know, maybe Newtonian mechanics in the realm that we work with, or chemistry when we're not into exalting a regime, then every single claim that's being made is well supported by evidence. Think about the periodic table of the elements in chemistry. You know, why do we have exactly that particular table of the elements? Why does silicon come where it does? Why is why is carbon? I think the expression is quadrivalent, and so on. Every single question of that type that you can ask will be answered with evidential support by a competent chemist, right? You go through the whole science and there's just no room to move, right? That's what a mature science looks like.
Well,
now,
yeah.
We have...
Well, I was going to say, the usual argument goes something like, you know, Newton, 400 years. Oops, Einstein. You know, so
yeah.
I mean,
well,
why, you know, just as much confidence, in other words, for hundreds of years, and then suddenly not. I mean, we
can
could
I have, answer that in a in a moment, because I had more to say about the first point.
Sure.
When sciences are emerging, when sciences are developing, you don't have that structure at all, right? When science is developing, it is quite common to have multiple competing theories, because we don't have enough understanding of the facts to nail down any particular theory. So I want to emphasize that it is an extraordinary thing when we come to a mature science where we have that structure, where everything has been nailed down. The sciences that tend to get most attention tend to be the ones that are newly emerging, that are developing, where we don't have that. And then it's certainly the case that the evidence is not pinning down any particular theory. The prominent example in physics at the moment is theories of quantum gravity. You know, we have this proliferation of many different theories, and we just don't know what's going on. It's just for a lack of evidence. Now let's get back to your question. So what about this idea of scientific revolutions? I think the history has just been badly written here. There's this idea that Einstein showed that Newton was wrong. We all thought Newton had got it all nailed down, and now Einstein was wrong. No, that isn't at all what happened. In the domain in which Newton was working, he had exactly that kind of maturity. That's why the theory survived so well for so many years. But you can't expect the theory to keep holding when you move into domains that are well removed from those in which you've collected the evidence. So Newton had no evidence collected for the domain of very rapidly moving bodies. He had no evidence for the domain of extremely strong gravitational fields. He had no evidence for what happens on very large scales, on cosmic scales. He had no evidence for what happens on the microscopic scale, the molecular scale, the atomic scale. And so in all of those regimes, his theory breaks, right? You have special relativity for the very fast, general relativity for gravity, cosmology for the large scale, quantum mechanics for the very small scale. But one of the things that those theories are obligated to do and have to do and succeed in doing is to return Newton's theory for the domain in which Newton operated, right? And so I just think it's a mistake to say Newton was overturned. No, we still use Newtonian mechanics to send rockets to the moon. Engineers still use Newtonian mechanics to design buildings and bridges and so on and so on and so on. So I'm not really terribly bothered by that. We had that mature structure in the domain in which Newton was working.
Okay.
I've got more to say on this, but I don't know if you... Okay.
Go ahead.
So the point that I want to make is I think that the common wisdom in philosophy is just mistaken. The idea that you can never have a single theory picked up by the evidence is just an obsession of philosophers because they kind of like the idea. It's appealing. What's weird about it, it is so completely at variance with what actually happens in science. In science, we see over and over again that theories mature and they become quite, you know, well established. Look, for example, at evolutionary theory. Right? It's nailed down. The Academy of Sciences spends a lot of time trying to argue that, you know, that creationists have just got it wrong. Evolutionary theory is the theory, and you can't do anything about it. It just keeps going again and again and again. The puzzle for me is why philosophers have allowed this common wisdom to become so entrenched. The short answer is a really deficient theory of inductive inference. If you look at the people who write mostly about this, people like Quine, for example, they have a very naive view of inductive inference. It's essentially hypothetico-deductive, and we just know that's a bad inference form. Right. It isn't strong enough by itself to do the job. It just tells you that if you have two theories that entail the same phenomena, right, then they are both equally well supported. And that's just nonsense. No, they aren't equally well supported. Take geology. The geology of the Earth, it gives us a very detailed history of how everything was formed. And take the competing theory that just says the world was created 5 minutes ago by a benevolent or malevolent God who created everything in place the way we see it now, complete with the fossil records and the like. They are not both equally well supported by the evidence that we see. The first theory is powerfully supported because every single detail has a particular piece of evidence in support for it. Why is the Grand Canyon as deep as it is? It's because the Colorado River has been running for this amount of time over rocks that are subject to erosion at this rate, and that's why it's exactly the way it is. Why in the second theory is the Grand Canyon as deep as it is? It's because God willed it so.
But that isn't that, I mean, not that I'm supporting that idea, but what exactly is wrong with that?
I just told you, the theory.
I mean, for somebody who believes that, you know, that God created the Earth and the universe exactly the way it is, that may not be a satisfying answer to many people, but I don't see where it's been refuted.
I don't see why you don't see where it's been refuted. I just told you the difference. And the difference is that every particularity in the geological account has independent evidence in favor of it. The other account does not have that. Why 5 minutes ago? Why not 10 minutes ago? Why not 20 minutes ago? Why not 2,000 years ago?
Well, you can always give answers. I mean, because God didn't want to create it more than 5 minutes.
Okay.
Or something like
that. What is the evidence that God didn't want it?
Right? Well, I mean,
the evidence that God didn't want it? Maybe he did want to, but he was busy that day.
Yeah,
and so
well,
he got distracted,
I mean, at that point,
or,
it becomes...
Or maybe he tried and he failed, or...
Well,
you know,
maybe it becomes... I think at that point, it usually becomes something like, you know, God's will is unknowable.
Yeah, that's fine with me. But now we just go back to the basic question, what do we have evidence for? And if we take God's will to be unknowable, then we're giving up.
Ah, okay. Okay. No, that's fine. I'm just... You know, playing devil's advocate of somebody who is I'm not sure they would be. I'm not sure that they would be convinced. They would simply say God, 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 and His will is unknowable, and that may be not satisfying, or scientific for that matter.
Yeah, my interest here is not psychology of whether I'm making people happy or not. My interest is what does the evidence support. And you might be very happy with the idea of believing things for which there is no evidential support. I don't want to make you unhappy. If this is you as devil's advocate is made happy by this, that's fine. I'm asking the question, a question in inductive logic. What do we have evidence for? And I'm saying the idea that the two hypotheses both entail the same evidence does not have the consequence that they are both equally well supported. And this is the big mistake that has been made endlessly. It's simply amazing to me. Quine has legendary status for his analysis here, and it's based on this mistake. Now, Quine writes in a very obscure way, so it takes a lot of work to see that this is the idea. The key to it, to understand it, is that Quine is a logician who works on deductive logic. So all he deals with are deductive relations, and so he doesn't have in the repertoire, right, enough of the logical machinery needed to see the sorts of things. I have more to say about this because there's a further question. It is a fact that we do end up with theories of science that are mature in the way that I've described. There are two open questions that need to be answered here. One of them is, I see it's possible that you can have a theory that is well supported in the way that I described, but might the same evidential base support another different theory in the same way? Right? You see the idea? And then the second question is, how does this come about? Right? So I've worked a lot on this. You'll find chapters that are written about this. So let's take that worry head on. What if there are two theories that are mature in the sense that I've described, but make factually different claims? Well, here I'm an empiricist. If they make factually different claims, right, then there has to be some manifestation in the world of those differences. And if there's a manifestation in the world of those differences, then in principle, something we experience can pick them apart. Now, it might be the case that it's very hard to get to those experiences, and then we simply have a matter of undetermination, of a transient undetermination until we can get the evidence, and that can persist for a long time. There's a real concern that in the case of quantum gravity, we might permanently be in that case because we simply cannot access intense enough gravitational domains in order to get the evidence that's needed to pull things apart. That can happen. But that is not a failure of the determination of theories by evidence. It's just a lack of evidence. The underdetermination thesis in its strong form says that it doesn't matter how much evidence we ever have, right? We can never separate the two theories. So that's the first thing. Insofar as we're empiricist, as indeed I am, I have another book I'm writing, I'll mention parenthetically on empiricism, that idea of those two theories is unsustainable. If it turns out that we have two theories that we believe are factually different, but the factual differences manifest in nothing that can possibly be experienced, then we have a really serious candidate for two theories that are in fact not different theories at all. The very fact that we can know that the two theories do not differ on anything that manifests in experience suggests that we have a very powerful theoretical grip on the relationship between the two theories. And that in turn suggests that we have ways of translating one theory into the other. And if you have that, then you have the basis for saying maybe these theories are just notational variants, one of another. This is what a conventionality claim looks like in physics. We have all sorts of examples of that that were developed through the course of the 20th century, starting with Hans Reichenbach, who developed lots of conventionality claims and they're developed. Okay, that was the first thing. I had a second thing to say about this. And that is, there's something quite particular about the material theory of induction that encourages this kind of convergence onto a single mature theory. And it comes about in the following way. Let's say in the earlier stages, we have two theories that are in strong competition with one another over which is the correct theory. And momentarily, we may have difficulty figuring out which is the correct theory. Now, that competition is very unstable according to the material theory of induction. It's a very particular thing that the material theory gives you. Let us say, instability comes about, if you try and balance a pencil on its tip. If you can get it just perfectly exactly right, then you imagine it'll stay balanced. There are physical reasons why that doesn't work, but that's another question, right? However, the instability comes about because if there's a very slight perturbation in any direction of the pencil tip, right, of the topmost end, then that gets amplified and the pencil will tip over in one side. That same mechanism is working in evidential competitions in science. If we have two theories that are competing with one another and we momentarily cannot pick them apart, right, all it takes is for one of those theories to have some slight evidential edge over the other, to learn something new of relevance. Uh-huh. And the material theory now tells us that the inductive capacity of that theory has been enhanced at the cost of the other theory. Uh-huh. Right? And that then snowballs. Right? You then find that the theory that got the small edge can then amplify that edge and can get stronger and stronger and stronger, and the other theory gets weaker and weaker and weaker.
Still getting around to that fix on your car? You got this. On eBay, you'll find millions of parts guaranteed to fit. Doesn't matter if it's a major engine repair or your first time swapping your windshield wipers. eBay has that part you need, ready to click perfectly into place. For changes big and small, loud or quiet, find all the parts you need at prices you'll love. Guaranteed to fit every time. But you already know that. eBay. Things. People. Love. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So I have, again, lots of examples of that because it's an interesting phenomenon that works in inductive inference. The one example that I had most fun with was the history of dowsing. Dowsing started in the 16th century in the Harz Mountains of Germany, where miners had this idea. They found that hazel trees would grow over mineral deposits. And so they had this idea that minerals were attracting hazel twigs. So if you took a twig and walked around and see where it was pulled down, you could figure out where the mineral deposits were. And in the 17th century, in the 16th century, that was not an implausible thing to pursue, because we realized that there were all sorts of actions like that. There were magnetic interactions between things in the earth and above, and there were electric actions, and why not a mineral action on a hazel twig? Well, of course, you know where it all ends up. There's an ongoing debate for centuries between the proponents of dowsing and the critics of dowsing, and you gradually see one step after another. The critics of dowsing develop a greater and greater purchase over the physical processes that are at work, and the dowsers are playing catch up. They're playing catch up. They keep needing to add extra hypotheses for which they have no independent evidence, until by the beginning of the 20th century, it's in total collapse. The dowsers are reduced to saying that there's some mysterious psychic power that is driving everything. And of course, once you've resorted to mysterious psychic powers for which you have a little understanding of the mechanism, you're in very deep trouble. You have no independent evidence for how these mysterious psychic powers are working, whereas if you're talking about electricity and magnetism and gravity and stuff like that, you have masses of independent evidence that nails down precisely how they work. So lots of other examples, but you get a sense of how that instability works. So it's go ahead.
So let me. I mean, you mentioned, Quine got things, terribly wrong. But I would have thought, your main, you're kind of the anti-Kuhn as well. Would you say so?
Yes.
You don't talk. I mean, he talk about hugely influential, and you're saying no. He got it all wrong. Or 90% of it, 95% maybe.
There's a kind way and there's an unkind way to look at Kuhn. The kind way is to say the following. You can say that science is a social activity, and you can ask, how is it that science is like other social activities? And then a lot of what he says really fits. Right? Mm-hmm. Scientists do tend to have movements, you can call them paradigms, and they do tend to get entrenched in their views and the way that people in other in other activities do, and then you have these, you know, and then you have these moments when everyone changes their mind. It's a bit like a religious conversion. You can imagine competing religions, and a new religion comes in and it wipes out the older one, and everyone gets converted. That's perfectly fine. And there's no question that science is a human enterprise, and you're going to find lots of similarities. Mm-hmm. The question that interests me is not how is science like other activities. It is like others in many ways. I want to know how it's different, because it's different in a way that makes it distinctive from everything else. And the distinctiveness lies in the use of evidence. And that's simply not carried out effectively by Kuhn. Kuhn is a terrible analyst when it comes to this. One of the places where he fails most seriously is his work on epistemic values. Again, you can read about this. It's in the first book. There's a chapter on values. It's simply a misleading mistake. The thing about Kuhn is he's actually a very bad philosopher. He doesn't articulate things well in the manner that philosophers expect. That is, a clear thesis and a strong argument in its favor. He talks in pictures and metaphors. The metaphors of religious conversion is a big one. If you want to know how a good philosopher tackles exactly those same issues, read Feyerabend. Now, I don't agree with what Feyerabend says, right? But Feyerabend does it well. He plays the game the way philosophers should. And so this is what Kuhn does with values. He insinuates that a lot of what we do in science is just a matter of personal preferences. Now, why is it that we prefer consistent theories? Why is it that we prefer simple theories? Why is it that we prefer more accurate theories? Why is it that we prefer fertile theories? Well, it's a value, right? And, you know, and these are epistemic values. And he plants in us the idea through that metaphor that these are things that we just choose because we like it. You like consistency, I don't. You favor consistent theories, I don't. You're a vegetarian, I'm a carnivore. Who's to say who's right? This has been a disaster because it's simply a mischaracterization of what's going on here. These are not values in the sense that they're freely chosen and ends in themselves, right? We don't prize a theory merely because it's consistent. We prize it because the property of consistency is a condition of truth. Right, so what's really going on is we like all of the things that Kuhn has said because they are criteria that guide us towards the truth. Right, we prefer consistent theories because if we have an inconsistent theory, it's more likely to be false. Right, we like simple theories for various reasons. There's a whole chapter in the book, but simplicity can be a guide to truth in the ways that I indicate. If we just like simplicity, we wouldn't have 90 plus elements in our periodic table. We'd just have four. Earth, air, fire, and water is a great deal simpler. We don't like accurate theories because we have a fetish for accuracy. They're more likely to be correct. We don't like fertile theories because, well, it's fun. It's because when a theory is fertile, it's an indicator that it's doing something right. So, you know, I think, you know, there are pluses and minuses in Kuhn. The plus in Kuhn is that he alerted us to the idea that science is indeed a social enterprise. And he also told us that we should take seriously the history of science. This was a great thing. But he was a terrible philosopher.
Well, and he was a historian, right?
So. Yes, I was going to praise his history, by the way. he was a terrible philosopher because he traded in metaphors and pictures, and he found it extremely difficult to state clearly what he meant. Now, as a historian, I think he was a great historian as long as he was not drawing general morals. In the late 1970s, he wrote a book on quantum discontinuity. And he advanced the argument that was shocking to people at the time, that Max Planck had not actually introduced quantum discontinuity in the revolutionary way we now think. But that really happened later with Einstein. And if you only have to go back and read Planck's original papers to see that he was right. And, you know, in my view, this is one of the great landmarks in history of quantum mechanics. I don't think he got it exactly right, but he shifted the discussion in exactly the right direction. I just lament that he was unable to apply the same rigor to his thinking and philosophy of science.
So let me switch topics a bit to circularity, which you mentioned before, which I mentioned before. So yeah. A very interesting aspect. I mean, we're not going to have time to go into all the different, you know, aspects of the large scale structure. I mean, I think we'll have to leave that to the readers. But there is an interesting discussion of coherentism, right? And so you might think that this is a coherentist theory, right? I mean, you know, in a flat-footed sort of way. But you actually disavow that. So the problems that coherentists are worried about are not worries for your problem. So can you tell us a bit about, you know, how you, you know, supporting this large-scale inductive structure where everything gets its, you know, warrant from some other fact, which gets its warrant from some other fact, and so on, and there's circularity. Why isn't that a, you know, coherentist theory?
Sure. Let me say two things about it. The first thing I want to explain is why the sort of circularities that I talk about are not harmful. And then the second thing I want to talk about is why this is not a coherentist epistemology. Okay, so we do those two things. So the first thing is this. When you look at the large-scale structure of inductive inference, I argue it's not hierarchical. There are big circularities that come about. I have lots of examples of these circularities. A simple example would be what happens in carbon dating. We have two ways of dating artifacts. One of them is archaeological, right? We look at the history of you know, various pharaohs, and we can donate a sarcophagus from that history. We can also get a sample of something carbonaceous from the sarcophagus and use radiocarbon dating. And each of those have been used to support the other, right? If you want to affirm that the dating of these ancient artifacts is correct, you might use carbon dating. But carbon dating needs to be calibrated because the levels of carbon-14 in the environment changed. And so you would use the archaeological dating to calibrate the carbon dating. So things go backwards and forwards. This happens over and over again. Little circles, big circles, huge circles. Now, there's a default amongst philosophers of science or philosophers that if you have a circularity, then you're dead, right?
Yes.
Then, you know,
it's bad.
Well, this requires more thought because there are different ways that circularities arise. You can have a vicious circularity, such as Russell's paradox, the Liar paradox, and then, yes, you're in serious trouble. We don't have those in the relations of inductive support that I talk about. Or if they do appear, they appear as a reparable problem. If you find there's a contradiction in the system, you gather more evidence and iron it out. The other way that they can happen is that the circularities are irresolvable. Right? You need to know this, you need to know that, but to know that, you need to know this, and there's no way to break the circularity. Then you have a convention. Perfectly fine with me. And then finally, you have circularities that is completely benign. We're used to them in all sorts of different ways. You know, I tell you, a fish is 10 inches long plus half of itself, right? There's a circularity in the definition, but I've just described a 20-inch fish. Yeah, no problem there. Or more seriously, if you look in examples of physics, Maxwell's equations written in the 19th century, early 20th century fashion, has four equations, and all the quantities refer to each other. They're all circular. But no one says that there's something seriously wrong with Maxwell's equations. And I argue at some length that this is the nature of the circularities that you find in mature scientific theories. They're just pinning down what's happening in a way that's benign. Okay, so why isn't this a coherentist epistemology? Mm-hmm. Well, the basic structure is the same at the very superficial level, that all the parts fit together and the claim is it's good. But now, what are the differences? Well, the first differences are the relata. In the work that I do, the relata are propositions, right? They're propositions, you know, making assertions about states of things in the world. In epistemology, the relata are beliefs, right? In the work that I do, the relations between the relata, logical relations defined in a completely non-subjective way by background facts in epistemology, the relations between beliefs are dynamical processes of mind, right? In the first case, I think we have a clear grip on what these inductive relations are. In the second case, epistemology is in deep trouble because it keeps doing just armchair psychology, right? Epistemologists are constantly guessing at what sorts of processes are underway in the mind that are connecting beliefs. And one of the things we learn from empirical psychology is that this sort of armchair psychology is deeply flawed and doesn't work very well. Now, the next thing that happens is that in work in coherentist epistemology, there's not a clear idea of exactly what a relation of justification is, right? These relations of support that are relations between beliefs that are implemented by mental processes are supposed in turn sometimes to implement relations of inductive support. But there is no good theory of inductive support there. When I read through the literature, mostly it's just impressionistic, very naive, simple ideas about inductive inference, sometimes probabilistic ideas that are not well thought out. And then finally, I'll mention the truly major problem, the downfall of coherentist epistemology has been that it tried to work things without a proper connection to the world. It was in opposition to foundationalism, where you have these facts that are simply known primitively as foundations, and they supposedly come from experience in the world. I won't go into that. I think there are difficulties with that. But at least there's a story of how the world gets into your belief system. Coherentists tried to do away with that because they wanted to be the alternative to foundationalism. And strictly doing that is what eventually brought them down. My latest reading, Coherentist Epistemology, is that it's been largely abandoned, except for, I believe, there's a Bayesian literature out there on coherentism, which I don't think is working very well. I have a whole chapter on this in the book, and you can see more details of that there. Does that answer well enough?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, interested people can certainly look in those chapters.
So can I just mention one thing? If you do want to look at the book, it's published open access.
Yeah.
So you can download the PDF for free. You can get it from my website. You can get it from various repositories. You can get it from the publisher. Please just download the thing for free and read it.
Yeah. Let me ask, I mean, one of the things, when you say the word induction in front of a philosopher, you know, sort of the first thing that's going to spring to mind is the problem of induction, and which, you know, again, there is probably not one problem, but certainly Hume's problem of induction. Can you say a little bit about how your theory of induction, you know, is related to, I mean, you claim it dissolves the or some of the problems of induction. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I can't deal with the issue that people just have anxiety about induction, right? There's a thing I call inductive anxiety, which worries people.
Inductive anxiety?
Oh, it's just a sense that there's something fishy going on and something worrisome that as I think someone in the 19th century said, induction is dubious because we reap where we have not sown. Right? What I can address is Hume's celebrated problem of induction. The first thing I want to say is it might turn out that there's no special advantage from the material theory in addressing Hume's problem of induction. If so, that puts me in the same position as everybody else. It's not a special deficiency of my account of inductive inference. Everybody else has the same problem. So that's the first thing. Second thing, in fact, I'm not in that position because once you adopt the material approach to the nature of inductive inference, you actually escape the traditional Hume problem of induction because you can't set it up anymore. Hume's problem of induction comes in two forms. One of them is the form that Hume and Reichenbach and Russell advocated, and that is there is some kind of rule or principle of inductive of induction, a principle of regularity of nature, or something like that. And the idea is that you cannot have any inductive support for that principle without entering into a circularity, and a harmful circularity. The idea is, if you want to say the past regularity of the world, the past success of the principle is evidence for its future effectiveness, no, you need to apply the principle to itself. All right, so you need this universal principle. There's a second version that's due to Popper, in which you have a hierarchy of principles. You say there's a first level principle of induction, and then we can know that through an inductive inference that uses a second level principle of induction. And so we have this infinite hierarchy, and you have an infinite regress. The key thing about both of these accounts is that they need universal rules of inductive inference, and I don't have them. So you actually can't set up the problem. All right, now, that's the beginning and the end of it. But the problem of induction, as I think any philosopher knows, is like the monster in a horror movie. You're 10 minutes from the end of the movie and you think the monster's been killed, and suddenly, the monster jumps up again. The problem of induction always comes back. And so there's been quite a literature of people saying, no, there's an analogous problem for the material theory of induction, and they describe various ways in which they believe this comes about. We've actually addressed all of them, and I'll just say none of them actually work. One of them is the issue of if you have a material theory of induction, your inductive inferences can actually never get off the ground. You start out only knowing particulars. How can you ever have an inductive inference to a generality? You need a warranting fact of general scope. And you don't have one by supposition because you're starting out with nothing. I've answered that. We use hypotheses, and I've described how that works. Another possibility comes at the other end. Every inductive inference supposes that there is a further inductive inference supporting its warranting fact, and so on and so on and so on. So why don't we have this infinite regress of warranting facts that ascend to ever greater heights of generality? And the answer to that is fairly straightforward. In order to have that, you would need to assume that relations of inductive support are structured hierarchically. So you have to go to ever greater levels of generality. And that is just not the way inductive inference works. I've emphasized at some length a lot of crossing over of inductive support. You just don't find that hierarchy. So that fear is not implemented in a mature science. And then finally, there's, but isn't it circular, right? Aren't there circularities, and isn't that the same circularity? No, the sorts of circularities that are implemented by relations of inductive support in the material theory are not the vicious type that we're used to as being harmful. They're the benign types, such as you find between the equations of Maxwell's electrodynamics. So, I think I can sit back. My work there is done.
Well, let me. I think I'll have time for one sort of more substantive question. So, when we started, you started with the example of Marie Curie, right, and the radium. And you said, no, she wasn't doing a enumerative induction or anything like that. Well, clearly not. But I was just wondering, I mean, so enumerative induction, if you're taking a course in, reasoning, critical reasoning, or something like that, not deductive logic, but just a more general course, you will be taught things like, this is enumerative induction, this is inference to the best explanation, and so on for various, there's an argument from analogy, right? So there's certain standard labels, at least, for various types of inductive inference. Are you still like going along with those labels, at least? Or do you think that, no, we shouldn't even be talking in any form of generality about induction?
It's a difficult thing. I'll say two things about it. The first is the experience of teaching, and the second is how I think practically we can continue. First, the experience of teaching. Having taught classes like this, I've always felt a bit like a fraud. Because I kind of know that there is no universal form of inductive inference that's going to make these things work. And so I kind of have to cajole and push the students until eventually, intuitively, things carry the day. I've not been happy with that. And when I talk to other instructors, they will confide in me a similar sense of discomfort. So what's the right way to think about it? Well, I think we should be honest about it and say that all of these forms of inductive inference are ultimately materially warranted. However, if you narrow things down to a smaller domain, you can find that things that look like those rules, in fact, do work well, as long as you restrict the domain over which those inferences work. So take the case of enumerative induction. You can't do enumerative inductions over the place at which the crystals formed. You can't say that this sample of radium chloride was prepared by Marie Curie in Paris. Therefore, all samples of radium chloride will be prepared by Marie Curie in Paris. Mm. Okay, you need background facts to tell you where you can do it. And you can do it for things like the crystallographic form of the substances. You can do it for things like, say, melting points of elements, because each of these are in turn supported by background facts. Now, there's a similar sort of thing that you can do for arguments for simplicity. Think about curve fitting. We are told that we should fit the simplest curve that we can, and we ought to trade off the simplicity of a curve against accuracy of fit. There comes a point where we should stop getting more and more accurate fits when we do our regression analyses. Now, why is that? That's because we have some background facts that tell us which sorts of functions are the most likely ones. Now, our default is to go with something like linear and then quadratic and then cubic and then so on up. And you would put right at the end of that hierarchy an infinite order polynomial, right? That would just be bizarre. Well, it's not bizarre if the circumstance calls for it. And when does the circumstance call for it? If you have any periodic phenomena that interest you. For example, you might be interested in the tides. You want to do tidal prediction. And then when you're fitting curves, you're going to start out with periodic functions, sines and cosines. Right. Now, they are infinite order polynomials. You wouldn't start out fitting a linear curve and then a quadratic. That would make no sense. And it would make no sense because of the background facts. So if you keep in, you know, and so you can, anyway, you get the way, the idea way this works. You can go through the various different argument forms and you can see how they can in turn be justified by background facts. Argument from analogy works in the same way. This is a rather pretty example in the material theory. Philosophers think of analogy as an argument form, right? Identified as far back as Aristotle. Scientists, however, think of analogies as facts, as a fact of analogy. Right? And this is this odd disparity between what philosophers and logicians say and what the scientists themselves practice and do. Well, there's one account that brings the two together, right? And that's the material theory of induction. If you ask what is the fact that is authorizing an analogical inference, it is the fact of the scientist. There's a whole chapter on that in the in the book, The Material Theory of Induction. And so that's the way that I would say we have to teach this kind of material. Otherwise, it can be difficult to connect what the students already have heard and what they read in the textbooks with what is a responsible treatment of inductive inference.
Very good. So we're just about out of time, and I'd like to end with a question about what's on your short-term or medium-term horizon. Are you, you mentioned working on a book on empiricism. What's on your plate right now? What should we look forward to as well?
Yes, well, the next book is a book on empiricism. I advocate a form of empiricism I call small e empiricism. The difference between that and other prominent forms is the following. The standard accounts of empiricism have two theses. The first thesis is that what we know of the world, we learn from experience. So experience is the source of our knowledge of the world. I endorse that. I think that's correct. I think that's the right part of empiricism. The second part that I don't endorse is the idea that that is all we know of the world. You can look at Van Frassen's constructive empiricism as a really extreme version of that. He insists that all we truly know of the world is what we experience directly. That's just wrong. That's just an example of quite severe inductive skepticism. I would like to stop thinking of that as empiricism at all. It's just inductive skepticism. Anyway, lots and lots of consequences for that. If you look at a lot of the work that I do, I'm asking what should an empiricist say about things like possibility and causation and thought experiments and, well, inductive inference. And you'll see there's a very large corpus of work that is going to go into this book.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us at New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I, you know, as you mentioned, the book is freely available online. So there's plenty more to talk about, but we won't be able to. But thanks again, and good luck with the next book.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And thanks for having me. I've enjoyed talking with you very much.
Thank you. Bye. You've been listening to my interview with John Norton, distinguished professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. We've been talking about his new book, The Large-Scale Structure of Inductive Inference, which is just out from BSPS Open and University of Calgary Press, and is freely available, open access online. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.